December 18, 1989. Nami Nakashima Diaz interviewed by Kay Briegel at her home.
Many years, and they were all well educated. I went to Berkeley. Their parents sent them to Berkeley. And you know, all they had was a flower shop. They never had a job like as a, you know, just worked in the shop, went to market. And they were quite, we knew educated people, but they just, that's all they did. There was no place for them. Now, I think in Los Angeles, they had a better chance. Because Los Angeles was, it was a big city, metropolitan city. And the Japanese did. I think they worked in civil service and stuff like that. But Long Beach, you didn't see it.
So you never worked when you were growing up?
No, we just had a good time, I guess. That's too bad, though.
Yeah. What did you do? You graduated from college?
Uh-huh.
You came back from Spanish.
I just went to Banning one semester, and I graduated from Poly in 1934. But I was always, I didn't go on to school. I took a class at City College, and I was always taking violin lessons till I got married, and I quit taking lessons. And then I just, after that, I just took classes here and there at City College, which I still do. I love that old place. Don't know what I'd do without it. I just love taking classes there.
And so what did you do when you graduated from college? You took one class at City College, were you looking for a career as a violinist? Or?
Well, you know, I don't know what, I just really had not much direction. I was always taking violin lessons, and we used to play, and I just played, you know, they'd have these little city symphony orchestras, you know, they had the Long Beach Symphony Orchestra. I played in that thing when they first started, you know. Many years ago, there was the man who I think who first directed that. I think he was an army bandmaster. I think from what was this place in San Pedro, Fort MacArthur. I think that was the first one because then it started up into the Long Beach Symphony. That was many years ago. Then they had the Women's Symphony in Long Beach, and Anderson, you know,
Eva Anderson.
Yeah, is she still living, or did she pass away? Yeah. Well,
did you play in that?
Yes.
You did.
And Mr. Her husband, he was a detective, and you know, he left her and married a very young girl. She belonged to the. Yeah, he married a young girl, I think, that was playing. You know, I didn't know this until many years later. I used to see him walking down. You haven't got this on, have you?
Yes.
Oh.
Let me turn this back on.
Yeah.
You played in the Women's Symphony?
Yeah, Women's Symphony. This was something that was real interesting, too. Mr. Clark, Herbert L. Clark, was still living in those days. He was retired. He's an elderly gentleman living with his daughter, I think. And Mr. Whitaker. He said, we're having a dinner for him, you know, dinner for him. And he says, I'm going to have a blonde and a brunette and a redhead go and pick him up. And so I had a car. My mother had bought me a car. So I went, picked him up with, I can't remember the names. It was a blonde and a redhead and myself. We went and picked Mr. Clark up. And I forgot where he lived. It was somewhere in the east end of town somewhere. I don't know where. And we took him to, then it was a recreation clubhouse where we used to have our rehearsals. And we took him there, and he had, I think we had a party or something, dinner. And then we took him back. But that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, you were playing concerts with the women?
Oh, we had, I think it was a yearly concert at the auditorium downtown, the old auditorium. One time we drove up to Santa Barbara. And let's see, where else did we go that I remember? Because to me, I thought, oh, that's a long ways to go, because I drove up to Santa Barbara, and we came back that same night. But I forgot where else we might have gone. Isn't that funny? Yeah, I don't remember any place else.
Do you remember how you dressed?
Yes. I had a, I still have my long... I made a little long sheath, kind of a apricot colored. We all wore pastel colors. Long, it had to be long dresses, lace, you know. And I wore that. I used to just wear that for the concerts that we played. And I forgot what kind of shoes. I suppose I probably had maybe white shoes because I didn't have any shoes dyed to match or anything. I don't remember. But I remember Eva Anderson, when she came out, she had been, I think, on the stage, hadn't she? So she was quite magnetic. She had something about her. And it took her, she always dressed to look sparkling. She had white hair, mane white hair, and kind of just brushed back, you know. She was a short little woman and had a large chin. But she had beautiful blue eyes. And she always dressed to that white hair. I remember what kind of palish blue dress she had. That hair just shone beautifully. And when she first went up there, we were all seated there, and she'd come on a podium, you know, tap, and we'd start playing. But it was all quite a show, dramatic, you know, I thought. Because, well, I guess it had to be to look a little, we weren't professional. I mean, you know, we were just five students that had played fairly well, I guess, you know. And it was a good experience, you know. Then after, I can't remember whether I went into the, played with the Long Beach Symphony after that, because that was just a few times. I didn't play very long with them. Then Mr. Agronoff was going to move up to Washington, so he sent me to Mr. Borisov up in L.A. to take lessons. And he had the South Bay Symphony Orchestra, they called it in those days. It wasn't the Palace, but South Bay. But we rehearsed down at the school is down close to the bluff. No, is that it?
Yeah,
it's down there. It's just below as you go down that main highway, and you turn off towards the ocean. There's a school there. We held our rehearsals there. And I remember we played a couple of concerts there, too. And then by then I was married. And then I just dropped out. The lessons were quite expensive, and I wasn't working.
How did you meet your husband?
At a beach party. My son, my brother introduced me to him. Yeah. We've been married for 50 years. It's a long time. And he likes to paint. He worked on the waterfront. And all of his life, first when he was young, right after school, he worked as a longshoreman. And he worked there for a number of years, then he got into the Checkers local. And he worked there until he retired, so he's worked the waterfront all of his life. And but he liked artwork an awful lot. Now he takes classes at City College and paints. But,
how did things change for you during World War II?
Well, World War II, of course, after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, we didn't know what was going to happen to us, because there was a lot of talk, you know. They might round us up, and they might not, or something, you know, and we didn't know what might happen, because right after they took my father into camp, I wasn't living home, but my father said he asked the FBI to let him say goodbye to the rest of his family living at home. So they did at midnight. They took him over there, and he said goodbye to the younger brothers and sisters. And they took him off, but they didn't say where they were going to take him to. They just took the businessmen and took them. They were in Jerome, in Arizona, and they took them different places, I guess. And then we came home one night, and they had a note on the door by Sunday to take only what you could carry and meet at the station down here at the end of Ocean Avenue, or you'd be put in jail. So I wish I'd kept that notice, but we were everybody so scared of everything, you know, you just destroyed everything, you know. And so we boarded the streetcar, and we had to pull the shades down, and then they took us to Santa Anita. So I stayed there for 5.5 months, And we entered there, and they gave us...
What happened to your husband?
He went with me. We'd only been married a couple of years, and it was like the end of the world, so, you know, he just came with me. And he stayed with me for, I guess, about four months or something like that, and he thought, well, this is not getting us anywhere. He says, I'm going to go out and try to get you out. So then he came back here. But they wouldn't let him come back in again, and he couldn't get me out. He tried all over, and he couldn't, just wouldn't let me come out. But after another few months, then they let us out. Anybody who was married to a non-Japanese could leave. But they gave us this, we went, they were stables, and we were given a sack, you know, a folding cot and a sack filled with straw. You went and got straw and you made your bed that way. Now, we stayed there for a long time, you know, it's only 5.5 months. Later on, I think we had mats. They gave us mats to put on our beds. But, and then, I think the worst part, well, some of the people, their horses, they hadn't been cleaned out, the stalls, really, so it wasn't very clean, really. But the worst part, I think, was the food. You see, they weren't equipped. They had no refrigeration. And on Fridays was fish day, and I tell you, that fish was spoiled, really. And it was too bad because they had no refrigeration. By the time they brought those freight cars, and I guess the ice had melted, and the toilets would be all stopped because the people was terribly sick. It was really bad, sad. And but they had given us an awful lot of shots, so nobody ever got sick because they made sure that we had all enough shots in us that we couldn't come down with anything, you know. And then,
what had you been able to bring with you?
Just our clothes and a suitcase, what we could carry. And our bedding, if we had it, a blanket or anything, but you couldn't, that's all you could carry. And,
and what happened to the rest of your stuff?
Well, you see, I was lucky because we had our little house that we had to leave because we were married. And my brother-in-law took care of that. But my mother didn't have to go. She wasn't Japanese. And then I had a half-brother and half-sister. They didn't have to go because they weren't Japanese, so they took care of all the rest of the family stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of the Japanese didn't have it so easy because they left, and they hoped that people would take care. People said, yes, we'll take care of your stuff, but they didn't. They either took it and left or just they had to sell what they could for just they tell me they got nothing. They just left all that. It was sad because they did really lose all their belongings. We lost enough just because we had to leave our home and maybe we had something happen to the house or something, but some of these people really lost everything. They did. You know, my father, I know, where he was living, he lost everything because where he was staying, that people were supposed to take care of stuff and they didn't, you know. It was not too good, but the people who were married to non-Japanese were able to leave, and the rest of the folks were sent down to Arkansas, Jerome, Arkansas. That's where my family were sent. And meanwhile, by then my two brothers had left, and they were sent to Jerome. From there, the two brothers entered the army. Eventually, three brothers went in. My two sisters went to work in Chicago. They all left Chicago, and then they entered the army. And so my father stayed down in Jerome until, he was there, I guess, a couple of years, I guess. But then eventually he came back, and he became a citizen. They allowed them to become citizens. So he became a citizen, and he was happy for that. But he always said this place was the best place to live. He visited Japan twice. The first time he went back was, I guess, after 50 years. But he only stayed, wasn't even a month, and he came back. Things had changed too much. He didn't like it. And then when my brother was in the Air Force station down there in Japan, he went back again. And he stayed a month, and he came back. 2 months he came back. But... He came back, and I guess he didn't feel too good about losing everything, but at least he didn't commit suicide. Well, you know, so I guess he kept his sanity, you know, because he lost quite a bit.
What did he do after the war?
Well, he came back to the family home, and he lived in the front house with my sister and brother-in-law, and my mother had moved to a rear house, and he built, then he borrowed money and built two houses. They had two lots next to the family home. He built two houses on each lot there, so he had four houses that brought him in some income that way. And then he built another two houses farther on where there was another vacant lot that he had bought many years ago. So he just built that because that's all. Then he just lived off of the income coming in. So he never gave up. My father just, he never gave up. He came back and I guess he knew there was no business left. I saw him sitting in front of the fireplace and going through all his bills. Some of his people had died, owing him for, you know, all the fertilizer, just taking those things and throwing them in the fireplace, destroying them, because there was no use of it all. Just, building up all of his business. But when he came back, he just, he knew he had to do something, and that was the one option he had. He had some land there. He put houses on the land, because I remember he had to use something as collateral, because we had to sign his name on some property, 2 acres in Carson, so he could borrow the money to build these other places. So he always had business on his mind. And he was 84 when he died. He had all of his sharp, very, very sharp yet.
And how did you decide to come back and live in Signal Hill?
Well, I happened to see in the paper there was a lot. We were living on the west side. And things were beginning to change down there, so I noticed that there was a lot for sale in a paper. Someplace I saw it. Maybe I saw the notice or something. Well, I stopped here. So we thought it was a good idea maybe to move, because we had 2 children and only 1 bathroom. That was our main reason, too. And we had a house in the rear already, and we were living in the front house. No place to build there, so we had bought just adjoining to my parents' home then, because I felt comfortable there, so we had bought there. So we bought this property, and then later on my husband bought the property next to us, so we acquired 100 acres up here and just put our houses up here, so we just lived. My husband's retired naturally.
Then, what year did you move here?
We moved up here, built in about 60, in 61 we moved up here, but we had bought the property prior to that. With the intention of moving up here, but we've been up here quite a while now.
And you built the house yourself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we built this place first.
And how did you get along with the city inspectors and all the people from the city?
Oh, very well. Signal Hill's been very nice. When we moved up here, there was only one objection a lot of people had. I think Denham family sort of ran the city. It was just like a little town, their town. They owned it, literally. And I think no matter what happened, I guess his word, he was the word. That's the feeling a lot of people had. And that's the feeling I think I kind of had, too. As long as you were doing okay, no one bothered you. And I had real good luck with the city. I know that when I had any complaints, I was younger then, and I would take the time to go on the phone and complain. They would send someone right out, you know. I know when they started putting those lights in there, they were going to put one of the street lights way out there, which was the city limits of Long Beach. And I thought, well, what's the sense in letting Long Beach have the light? And I called up and I said, you know, there isn't a soul that lives out there. I said, we're the last house up there. Why in the world can't we have that last light closed? Yes, they moved it. Alley in here, they're very nice. Something happened out in the alley, you know. You just call them and they come right down. You know, the pipelines, the oil pipelines, a lot of them were still underground here, and we had a lot of trouble with them. They'd be cave-ins, and you'd take a step somewhere, and you'd just, I don't want them to take a step back here. And guys, you went down to my knee. Some letters didn't break my leg.
Yeah.
So they had to come in. They finally, eventually, because it ran through our, it ran through that porch out there all the way down to the alley, underground. They finally took it out, I think. They pulled it out some way and tapped it down so we weren't having problems. And they came out and fixed that. And just, if you had complaints, the city of Sydney Hill is very good that way. And any, even now, if you call the police, they're very good to come out. They respond much more so than Long Beach. So, no, we had, and we knew Bill, just lives next door here, a couple doors down.
Yeah?
Westby. He used to, when he first moved up here, he drove, let's see, the street cleaning thing, I think, or something. Just labor, just a young kid, and he just stayed with Signal Hill, and now then he was a building inspector, and just, yeah. The only bad thing, their inspectors weren't really, I guess they didn't care too much because they weren't too strict about things, and what we built here was landfill, a lot of Signal Hill landfill. Now they might be, they're much more careful now, but when we moved up here, they weren't, and we're just above a landfill, which I didn't know about, and we noticed that our house, we have a great big crack there going through there. Huge crack. You see, that wouldn't have happened had they put the screen and the bars that they do now and tapped in and made sure that the ground underneath was solid. They're doing that now. But that was our only thing that went sour. But like I say, in the years to come, they'll have the technology to fix things easier now. Right now, the only thing is to put another subfloor. I told my son, well, later on when we're gone, your kids decide what you want to do. They may not even want to live here. Who knows? You know, the areas change now so much, too. You don't know what's going to happen up here. We're industrial right over here, but this is a good buffer, these duplexes that came in, but who knows what might happen, you know. So as long as I'm comfortable here, that's all I care about, you know.
Yeah. What else should I have asked you about?
No, I can't. I don't know too much. You don't want to know about any more about camp or anything about. Well, I think that's.
Yeah, tell me more about Santa Anita.
Oh, I think I started to tell you about. Sometimes people would say, "Well, gee, they lived so well; it was like a just fun." But when you have your freedom taken away from you, it does something to you. And it's true when you read about these people who say they wouldn't talk about it. It's true. You block that out. You just absolutely block it. I don't think I ever told my kids about it. Never mentioned it. A lot of these young folks don't even know anything about it. But it's a terrible thing to not know where you're going. I remember my mother and I going all over. We went up to L.A. and we went to Fort MacArthur asking what might they do to us? They didn't know. They wouldn't say anyway. But we were terribly frightened what might happen. My father always said they thought they were going to put them on a ship and sink the ship. That's exactly what they thought they were going to do, or take them and shoot them. They had no hope when they wanted to pick them up. But the only time I really became a little really apprehensive was when the word got around they were going to move us out, you know. But then we got word we could leave in a couple of days. You were going to leave, but my brothers and sisters were going down too. We didn't know where. They didn't tell us where they were going to take them, but we found out later. But I started to say about the it was the only thing that was so bad. And you're not used to having all your comforts are taken away from you, and your food is horrible. You know, you can't eat the food. I mean, because there was, you know, you had it was just sort of hurriedly set up, so you can imagine nothing was stored properly. So you had a lot of rat infestation, and you had eggs that were, well, they had no refrigeration. Eggs were over ripe, so, you know, I mean, your sugar was fine. Your butter that we had, I think it was butter that they store, and it was too rancid, and to make things, do things, they put slaps all the bread with this butter, and it was dripping, and it was rancid. You couldn't really eat it. And so certain days we had just Japanese food. Well, of course, the people who are non-Japanese couldn't eat that food. because you're not used to it. My husband couldn't even, he'd just go through the line 3 or 4 times and get the bread, you know, because he didn't like rice, he didn't like the Japanese food. And they'd get milk and bread, but just things like that. But you had green flies a lot, and I just still, the thing that just makes me so ill yet when I think about it, one time there was maggots, and you know, this makes you awfully sick. So when you hear some people say, well, you hear these people say, well, no, they had it so easy, they didn't have to do anything. It was just the life of Riley. They shouldn't crab, you know.
It wasn't.
You go there and they say there were no guns. Well, I'm not blind, and those guards had guns. And the saddest part, they were mean about it, petty and mean. We had visitors once a week, was it, or twice? Gee, I blocked it so much, I can't think. But anyway, we had visitors, and they would try to bring us maybe a little cocoa or something, you know, to kind of fix up the milk, because the milk wasn't cold or anything. And I still remember they weren't supposed to bring anything in, nothing. But they would try to bring us instant coffee or cocoa. So they brought me some cocoa, and you know, they wouldn't let me have that. Took it away. Now, how could a bit of cocoa hurt you? You know, that if they're petty and mean about little things. You couldn't, you always had to have a pass to go out and visit. You didn't used to go out, you had to apply for a pass to go and visit somebody, you know. And they'd come and visit you. But they say that they didn't have the guard houses. Well, they always had the guards there, and they were always right above us. They didn't want you too close to the fences, and they were always right above us there. They had a place where you could walk around, all around there. You could, plenty of walking places, but you didn't get too near those. Didn't go near those fences because the guard, a guard house up.
Towers.
Always towers. Uh-huh. We had one especially. He was very, very ornery and mean. I used to wish, I wish somebody would get him and get out of here. He was just ornery. I guess maybe he just didn't like the Japanese. He just didn't like, he was ornery.
And what did you do all day?
Well, they put the people to work making these nets, you know, the camouflage nets. But I didn't go to work. I didn't. I just felt like I wasn't doing anybody any harm, and I didn't belong in there. And after they let me out, no one ever challenged me, because when I was younger, I think people who are have mixed Oriental blood, as you grow older, the Oriental blood seems to show more. And when you're younger, it's not true. I mean, your facial features do change. And people, never asked me what I was. Of course, I know the FBI had me always on record. I meant to write in for my file on it, too. I called a police station one time. They said they didn't keep the file because Mr. Whitaker told me. He said, Nami, he says, when you have a chance, he said, you go to the police station, ask them to look at your police file. Because he said, they've got a very good file on your family. This is a very nice file. He says, you go down and look at it. And I called one time, but they said, no, they didn't have nothing. I guess they didn't want me to see it. But the FBI always has files on everybody, and they always keep it on file. Now that there's freedom of access, I can get it. But when they used to come to the month when you're let out, the FBI man came out to see if you were still living, because I was living in the family home. It came to, that you were still living there and you hadn't moved out of the western area. And then I was carrying my first baby then. I had to quit work, and so I was staying home. And you know, when that baby was 1 week old or 2 weeks old, I received a card for him, a pass, permitting him to reside in the western area. So they had me under surveillance all that time. All that time. They knew when that baby was born, always. Like I have a pass there. Just that kind of, that's why I say stuff like that's petty. What is a newborn child going to do?
Yeah, he was pretty dangerous.
Isn't that ridiculous? Mm-hmm. So I don't know, now they're telling us we'll get $20,000. Well, I'm telling you that I'll believe that when they hand me $20,000, or when the $20,000 is worth maybe $5,000. I really think we're just going to be left waiting. I don't, and most of the people don't. I just think that they're going to wait until our money is just maybe worth $5,000. $20,000 someday will be worth only $5,000, the way things seem to be going. And by that time, maybe they'll give us some money, but I don't think we're going to get anything. I really don't.
Well, isn't there a lot more people will be dead?
Yeah, but now they've signed this thing where their kin will get it. I have a brother.